Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, "And now, a little honey from the rock," taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. We are introduced to a new figure in Daniel's prophetic photo album in Daniel 11:36. He is the king who will do as he pleases, sometimes called the willful king. We've actually been introduced to this person before in the book of Daniel, for he is the little horn of Daniel 7:8 and the prince who is to come in Daniel 9:26. The Apostle Paul in the New Testament identifies this person as the man of lawlessness, the son of destruction in 2 Thessalonians 2:3. He is the beast in the book of Revelation, chapter 13, and again chapter 19. This person is popularly known today as the Antichrist. The subject of the Antichrist in prophecy has always fascinated Christians. In the 1930s, a well-known Bible teacher named Leonard Sale Harrison wrote three popular books on Bible prophecy and traveled around America speaking on the subject. One of those books was titled The Resurrection of the Old Roman Empire, The League of Nations, and The Future of Europe. Sale Harrison claimed that the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini fit Daniel's prophecies. Mussolini began reviving the Roman Empire in the 1930s. He organized the Italian army into a powerful fighting force, rebuilt the city of Rome, and placed himself at the center of a state cult. He expanded the Italian empire to include Spain, Austria, the Balkans, and the Middle East. When the Bank of Italy USA became an international organization and he began printing fascist symbols on U.S. coins, Sale Harrison predicted that the day of the Lord would begin in 1940 or 41 and Mussolini would be the Antichrist. Of course, he was wrong. Mussolini was assassinated in 1945 while fleeing Italy with his mistress, and the Roman Empire never revived. This is the danger of studying prophecy. We dare not equate current events with prophetic fulfillment because we will likely be wrong when we do. Christians tend to be gullible when it comes to conspiracy theories and prophetic speculations. God did not give prophecy to fuel our apocalyptic conjectures. The value of prophecy is to establish general principles about God's sovereign holiness and our security in Him. We can trust His plan for our future because His plan governs world history. The point of prophecy is that we don't have to worry about the wars, the chaos, and the catastrophes that fill the headlines of our news feeds. Israel and America bomb Iran. Russia invades Ukraine. Financial and political unrest grip our world. But we put our trust not in our governments, but in God and His plan for this world. We learn from Daniel that evil is real, but God is sovereign as we study God's prophetic pictures. So we can say on the basis of Daniel 11 that the Antichrist personifies evil at Armageddon. We can learn from Daniel 11, verses 36 to 39, that the aim of the Antichrist is deification. Listen to Daniel's words. Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and will cause them to rule over the many, and will parcel out land for a price. Antichrist embodies the sinful desires of humans in excess. We all have these sinful tendencies toward pride and self-deification, but he has them to the extreme. Satan, of course, is the father of sin. So Antichrist personifies Satan in this world. Now, a disclaimer is important before we begin. I use the word Antichrist carefully. The New Testament speaks of many Antichrists that will come and go down through human history. The Apostle John wrote in 2 John 7, "For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is the deceiver and the Antichrist." Jesus said in Matthew 24:24, "For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect." We can see these antichrists as we look back over the last 2,000 years of human history. All of these antichrists prefigure the coming willful king of Daniel 11. And it is this king, in the end, that we call the antichrist, the culmination of all the antichrists. What can we learn about this man's nature from these verses? He is all about me, myself, and I, verse 36. This man will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. He's the ultimate megalomaniac. He is an absolute dictator who does whatever he wants to do. He magnifies himself above every god, meaning that he refuses to submit to any deity of any nation on this earth, including, of course, the one true God. He blasphemes God. He says monstrous things against God. Now, these predictions can be partially seen in the life of Antiochus Epiphanes, whom we studied up to verse 35. I believe that Antiochus Epiphanes illustrated this coming willful king, but the person identified beginning in verse 36 is different. He's the final king who will arise to fight God in the end times. I say that he is not Antiochus Epiphanes for two major reasons. First, as we go through this prophecy beginning in verse 36, we will see aspects of this prophecy that Antiochus never fulfilled. And second, Jesus spoke of this prophecy in Matthew 24, and predicted a future person who would come and bring about the final abomination of desolation. Jesus said in Matthew 24, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains." Well, Jesus lived after Antiochus, so this prophecy clearly relates to a future king who will desolate Jerusalem and attack God's people. Antiochus' abomination prefigured the final abomination yet to come. Now, back in Daniel 7, verse 8, we're told that this person will possess a mouth uttering great boasts. Now turn to Revelation 13, verses 4 through 8. John writes, "And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war with him?' There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain." So this person will raise himself up against God and God's people, but he will function within God's set boundaries. Daniel 11:36 tells us that he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. The indignation refers to the 70 weeks decreed by God in Daniel 9:24-27, in which God will purify the nation of Israel through suffering and judgment. Now, only 1 week remains of those 70 weeks, and that is the period known as the tribulation period. It will be a period of 7 years in which God is purifying Israel as a nation just prior to the return of Christ to set up his kingdom on the earth. We, the church, are not part of that period, for we are not part of national or ethnic Israel. This figure will have power only until the end of that decreed period of God's indignation on Israel is completed. The final Antichrist will engage in the cult of self-promotion, verse 37. The angel told Daniel in verse 37, "He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all." Some have thought that the Antichrist would be an Israelite because the phrase "God of our fathers" is used for the God of Israel in the Old Testament. However, there's no definitive proof in Scripture that the Antichrist will be an Israelite, and this expression is plural and best translated as "the gods of his fathers." In other words, the Antichrist has no use for the worship of even his own ancestral gods, nor any other gods. He will promote himself above all gods. He will promote himself above all national symbols. This is the cult of self-promotion. He will also show no regard for desire of women. This has been interpreted in two ways. Some believe that he will be homosexual, since he will have no desire for women. Except that is not exactly the expression used, so it is probably better, although still difficult, to understand this expression from a Jewish perspective. The expression, the desire of women, was a common expression among Jews to refer to the Messiah himself. The desire of every Jewish woman, every devout Jewish woman, was to be the mother of the Messiah. If the phrase is best understood then as messianic, then the Antichrist rejects the Messiah. He shows no regard for the Messiah, who is the desire of every Jewish woman. The Antichrist believes that might makes right, verse 38. The Antichrist will worship at the feet of power, at the altar of power. He will honor a god of fortresses, according to verse 38. His god will be power. The only value he cares about is absolute power. And he will lavish riches and treasures on the god of power. He will pour all his wealth into the pursuit of power. He will care about power more than riches. The Antichrist worships at the altar of absolute power. The rise of the Antichrist comes about because he has sold his soul to God, verse 39. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him and will cause them to rule over the many and will parcel out land for a price. The Antichrist will devote himself to a foreign, or literally strange, god who will help him conquer the world's greatest powers. I take it that this strange god ultimately is Satan, according to Revelation 13:2. The beast of Revelation 13 is the Antichrist of Daniel 11, and he gets his power and his authority to rule from the dragon, who is Satan. So this person's only god is Satan, and he sells his soul to Satan in order to conquer the world. Verse 39 goes on to say that his followers in turn sell their souls to him, just as he sells his soul to Satan. He demands absolute loyalty from his followers. The Antichrist will reward those who sell him their souls with realms to rule and land to control. These people would be granted geographical segments of the world to rule as a reward for the sale of their souls to the Antichrist, who sold his soul to the devil himself. We know that there are many Antichrists who prefigure this final Antichrist. They have similar characteristics to this man, although not to this extreme. John tells us in 1 John 2:18, "Children, it is the last hour, and just as you heard that Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have appeared. From this we know that it is the last hour." So we have seen this sort of thing in the past, even our recent past. So it should not surprise us in the future. For example, we now know that Adolf Hitler sold his soul to Satan. Historical records indicate that he worshipped Satan, and his power came from a supernatural and evil power. Satan used the lure of deification to gain control over Hitler. Some men want to become gods, and they will do anything to become a god. Adolf Hitler was one of those men. In exchange, Satan took control of his soul. Hitler, in turn, became a god to millions of people. Rudolf Hess, commander of Auschwitz, said he would have gassed his own wife, children, and even himself if Hitler had commanded it. At one of the Nuremberg rallies, a giant photo of Hitler was displayed with the words, In the beginning was the Word. The Lord's Prayer was changed to read, Our Father, Adolf, who art in Nuremberg, hallowed be thy name, the Third Reich come. Alfred Rosenberg, Hitler's good friend, blasphemed Christ and proclaimed the Church of Germany to be the Nazi movement. Listen to a few articles of faith proclaimed by the National Reich Church. Article 1. The National Reich Church of Germany categorically claims the exclusive right and the exclusive power to control all churches within the borders of the Reich. Article 13. The National Church demands immediate cessation of the publishing and dissemination of the Bible in Germany. Article 14. The National Church declares it has been decided that the Führer's Mein Kampf is the greatest of all documents. Article 18. The National Church will clear away from its altars all crucifixes, Bibles, and pictures of saints. So you see, my friends, it has happened before. And it will happen again, only much, much worse. Antichrists come and go until the end of the age. So first we see that the aim of the Antichrist is deification. And second, we see in verses 40 to 45 that the war of Armageddon leads to destruction. Daniel writes, At the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. He will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful mountain, the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. I believe that these verses are a description of what we call the War of Armageddon. It will occur over the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period, Daniel's 70th week, and culminate in one great battle with the army of Christ, when Christ returns to claim his kingdom on earth. Now, it's best to understand that this is a war, not a battle, sometimes called the Battle of Armageddon. It's really the War of Armageddon, for it encompasses many battles, not just one. This is a whole campaign, not a single battle. And it all starts with the lust for power in verse 40. At the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he will enter countries, overflowing them and pass through. Now, throughout this chapter, the king of the south has been identified already as Egypt. And the king of the north has been Syria, and more specifically Antiochus Epiphanes. I think the pattern continues in this photo album, so that the final war of Armageddon begins as a conflict in the Middle East. It is ultimately an Arab-Israeli conflict that draws the world into this final great war. The king of the south is still Egypt, in the coalition led by Egypt, because Egypt is named in verse 42. The king of the north is still a Syrian-led coalition in the end times. The hymn of verse 40 is a third person. This is the Antichrist. So this final world war is started by the nations around Israel who attack him, the Antichrist, in a pincer movement from the north and from the south of Israel. Historically, Israel's enemies have attacked from the north and south, as Israel is sandwiched between powerful Middle Eastern forces. And it will be the same in the end. Armageddon will be a Middle Eastern war that engulfs the world. How will this happen? In Daniel 9:27, the Antichrist, who is the head of a Western 10-nation empire, will make a covenant with Israel. The Western Confederacy will become Israel's protector and defender, bringing a period of peace and security to Israel because of the Western powers. After 3.5 years of peace and security, the Antichrist will stop the sacrifices and will commit the abomination of desolation that Jesus spoke about in Matthew 24. And Jesus told the Israelites of his day that when this happens, all Jews should flee the land because a time of destruction is coming unparalleled in human history. Sometime after the abomination of desolation, the Arab nations north of Israel and the nations south of Israel will join forces to attack Jerusalem and seek to eliminate Israel from the earth. They will attack Israel in a pincer movement from both the north and the south simultaneously. When this happens, the Antichrist and his Western Confederacy will rise to Israel's defense. Look at verse 41. He will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. The he in these verses is the Antichrist, because the him in verse 40 was the Antichrist. The Antichrist will attack this alliance first in the north, sweeping through Syria and on into Israel, known as the Beautiful Land. He will achieve partial victory. Many countries will fall to the armies of the Western Confederacy, but some will escape. God identifies the geographical territories of Edom, Moab, and Ammon as escaping from the control of the Antichrist. Now, we're not told why. Perhaps God protects them by his own power, or perhaps they were simply bypassed by the Antichrist in his quest for Egypt and northern Africa. These territories are all, of course, on the other side of the Jordan River. And we do know that the Jews will flee to these areas, particularly they will flee to Edom to escape the destruction of this time. And so God saves a remnant of his people from the hand of the Antichrist. Now, let me stop and talk briefly about the principle of historical relevancy in the study of prophecy. The principle is simple. God describes prophetic events in the language of Daniel's day, because there's no other way it could be understandable to Daniel and his people. So the geographical and military designations are given in ancient terms. They're anachronistic. This does not mean that the final war will be fought with chariots, and will involve the nations of Moab and Egypt, for example. These are the geographical names and the military terms that were understandable at that time. These are not necessarily the countries or the weapons used in the end times, although they could be analogous to them. The nations that correspond to these ancient geographical names will fulfill the prophecy in that time, in the end time. This leads to verses 42 and 43, and money, money, money. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. The Antichrist continues his conquest into Egypt and North Africa. He seeks the hidden treasures and wealth of this territory and gains control over this region. However, the modern nations who correspond to the Libyans and the Ethiopians are said to be nipping at his heels. The best way to understand this statement is that they are fighting back through basically what we would call guerrilla warfare. But before the Antichrist can deal with these insurrections from Africa, he hears rumors that disturb him. He is, after all, a control freak, verse 44. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. The rumors come from the east and the north of where he is, which is now in North Africa. Ezekiel 38 and 39 gives us a great deal of detail at this point. In summary, a northern coalition develops against the Antichrist, which is led by Gog from the land of Magog, according to Ezekiel. Ancient Magog occupied the area of northern Iraq today, and the region of the Caucasus Mountains. So I do not believe this coalition is necessarily led by Russia, as some have suggested. Rather, I believe it is still an Arab-Israeli conflict at its core. This is a coalition between the Black and Caspian Seas along the areas of Iran and Iraq, which rose to battle in this final world war, pulling other nations into the war as well. The Eastern Alliance also gets a lot involved. We know little about this one, but apparently a large army will rise up in the east to attack Israel and the Western Confederacy. India or China could lead this as we look at the geography of the world scene today. It is actually quite easy to see how this could develop as we look at a world map today, with the Northern Coalition, the Eastern Coalition, and the Western Confederacy. The contours of the final war in the Middle East are clear in this prophecy. The historic, natural enemies of Israel take center stage. In today's names, these include Iran, Iraq, Syria, Arabia, Egypt, and North Africa. All of this leads to the final stand, verse 45. He, the Antichrist, will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. Human history culminates in the land of Israel, where the Antichrist pitches his tents, so to speak. He makes his final stand in Israel. God draws the nations of the world against each other between the seas and the holy mountain of Israel. The world comes together in battle here. Armies from the east are pulled in, armies from the north and armies from the south march on the armies of the west encamped in the land of Israel. This is the War of Armageddon. For there is a valley that God says will be the site of the final battle. It is the Valley of Megiddo, or Armageddon. The plain or Valley of Megiddo lies between Mount Gilboa and Mount Carmel, southwest of the Sea of Galilee. The word Armageddon is only used once in the Bible, in Revelation chapter 16, verse 16. John tells us in Revelation 16, 14 to 16, that Satan and his demons lead humans to make their final stand against God. They are spirits of demons, John writes, performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. And they gathered them together to the place which in the Hebrew is called Harmageddon. This is the moment when Christ will return and defeat the armies of this world. He will establish his kingdom and will rule from Jerusalem. Human history culminates in Jerusalem. Israel is the center of God's plan for the world. So we watch as events develop, and we trust God and his plan for human history. In the aftermath of 9/11, many turned to what seemed to be an incredibly profound prophecy by the 10th century astrologer Nostradamus. One version of his prophecy that was sent to me contained these words: "In the year of the new century and 9 months from the sky will come a great king of terror. The sky will burn at 45 degrees. Fire approaches the great new city." Another version added this verse: "In the city of York, there will be a great collapse, two twin brothers torn apart by chaos. While the fortress falls, the great leader will succumb. The third big war will begin when the city is burning." Well, because of things like that, books by Nostradamus were purchased in record numbers. Three books about him were among the five top sellers on Amazon. Some stores sold out of all their copies. My friends, it was all a farce. The first verse was actually composed by a Canadian student named Neil Marshall in the 1990s, and the second verse was a bad attempt to embellish a verse that originally spoke of the ancient Normans. We've always been fascinated with prophecy, and particularly Armageddon. Many seek answers from a wide variety of sources when fear and insecurity flood their souls. I mean, people want answers. They want certainty. They will grasp medieval mystics like Nostradamus or conspiracy theories from the modern world to try to find answers for the future of our world. Even Christians can get caught up in these speculations and conspiracies. When catastrophes happen and the world seems to be falling apart, people crave certainty. My friends, we have the truth. We have the certainty. The Bible lays out the framework for the future. And it is a foundation we can stand on when all else is shifting sand beneath our feet. Our faith rests not in fabricated speculations of the modern era or conspiracies that people concoct, but in the prophecies given to Daniel over 2,500 years ago. Yes, Armageddon is coming. This is true. Evil will reach its apex of horror, true again. Man's depravity will eventually reach a point that invites God's judgment, because sin can never exceed God's boundaries. But evil will not win, my friends. Evil loses. God defeats evil at Armageddon. God wins. We know the end of the story. The angel's prophecy to Daniel gives us hope. We can find our security in the plan of God recorded in the Word of God.